It's beautiful, 8 a.m. I had a hard time this morning with that. So, we're starting a new unit. It's on tropical forestry. We saw Mosquito Coast last Thursday. If you didn't come, which was fine on that particular day, be sure to watch the movie. It's available for $2.99 on Amazon. It's not on Netflix that I can tell, but you can rent it and watch it. It's a great movie. Lots of fun, and the movie worksheet is due this week, as well as the outline, so you may need to watch it really quick if you haven't watched it yet, so you can do the worksheet. And the idea of the worksheet is not that it's worth a lot of points, it's worth a fairly minimal amount, but the idea is to help you prepare. You know, the last midterm had a fair amount about Dersu Uzala on it, so doing the worksheet is for you to help you know what to study, okay? It's not a grading thing with the worksheets. And next week we have a congressman lecturing on Tuesday. It would be good to come have a good number of people here. I have to introduce him, scares the crap out of me, frankly. But he's an interesting guy. His name is B. Reuter, and Doug Reuter. And he was one of the few people who was willing to admit publicly that the Iraq War was kind of a mistake, in his opinion. After the war was started, and maybe that has something to do with his eventually retiring from Congress. But he's also very involved in agriculture, and he's from Nebraska. He was congressman in Nebraska, and very involved in forestry. He's the incoming chair of the Arbor Day Foundation, which is a tree planting and tree caring organization around the world. So he was excited to come talk to a forestry class. Like, we're a forestry class, but we do have trees in the name, so that was good. So I think it's a real opportunity to have a congressman come speak. And I hope I'm encouraging him to leave plenty of time for questions. So let's have good questions for the man. On Tuesday, the 12th, he'll be here. And I will remind you of that. So we have the Mosquito Coast worksheet. We have the outlines due this week. We have a congressman next week. And we're starting a new unit on tropical forestry. So we have finished with our unit on the temperate forests of the United States and North America. And people always ask me, is that going to be on the next test? Well, maybe a little. I mean, from what your paper assignment is, I think you can see the papers that I might draw on might be Ostrom or Brinner, things like that. I might ask a little bit about tropical forestry versus temperate forest ecology, which is what we did last unit. So it's cumulative. The class is cumulative. The emphasis will always be on the most recent stuff, the most recent unit, but including the final, but it is cumulative. And I think we will probably maybe have the exams for you Thursday at the latest Tuesday. Okay. All right. So tropical forestry, I printed I uploaded an outline for you, so you have that. I want to remind us of this map of the biome. Switch for this is right over here, no? Oh, I see those lights. Well, this will be good. We're about to be plunged into darkness. Ah! Oh, hell with it. Oh, I see. All right, that's not bad. At least we got the front one off. Okay, so we started out looking at this little chart of biomes, regionals, vegetation types. And in the United States, we talked a lot about temperate deciduous forest and temperate conifer forest, these areas in here. Now we're going to move into tropical evergreen forest, tropical montane forest, and tropical dry forest. Now, what are some of the things that characterize the climate of a tropical area? Down here we have the rainfall, and over here we have the temperature. So what conclusions do we reach about the climate in a tropical type of forest compared to a temperate forest just from looking at this graph? Badly focused graph. Don't know how to focus this overhead projector. What's different about the tropics? Yes, ma'am. High temperature and high moisture. Wet and hot, okay, like your socks. And all the time, right? There's no seasonality. We don't have spring and summer and fall and winter and a lot of the tropics. There's some seasons. We looked at a graph of a dry tropical forest where part of the year it was drier. In some places there's seasons. But in the tropics down near the equator, the temperature is pretty much the same at sea level, at the same elevation. But one point that the reading makes, and the reading for tropical forest ecology is great. I'm not crazy about the one for temperate forest ecology, but the one for tropical forest ecology I think is really a great reading. So I really, really urge you to do that reading if you haven't done it already. It's very clear and it explains a lot about the tropics. It's just a great reading. And it's summarized very well for you in the outline that I posted. So the tropics are pretty much the same temperature and rainfall, a lot of them, all year round. So a very steady, that's the classic tropical environment. But there are things that can cause variation in temperatures in the tropics that are talked about in the chapter. Does anybody have an idea what one of those things are that might cause you to have a colder climate in a tropical region than you would expect? Well, elevation, okay? So if you have mountains that go way high up, that will be cold up there, okay? It'll be colder. So they have gradients of temperature based on elevation. So when we talk about the tropics, a latitudinal gradient, where when you get down near the equator, it's warmer and wetter and more steady state. But there are also elevational gradients where temperatures drop as you go up. One of the things that the book talks about, which is kind of fascinating, is that when the temperature is pretty steady and you have an elevational gradient, it's like Jell-O. You know, the Women's Faculty Club serves the best Jell-O. When I go there, that's why I go there. I'm thinking about that Jell-O. I don't care what it's made of, really, but it's striped. You ever seen the Jell-O that has stripes, just beautiful, like a green layer and then a red layer and then a... How many people have never seen that? Wow. What part of the United States are you from?
The Delta.
The Delta. Oh, really? Like from Locke or something? That's a great area. I'm not going to talk to you about that. Okay. So maybe some people haven't seen this Jell-O. I can assure you, I'll take you there. We'll have Jell-O. So the thing is, though, that in a tropical climate, like here in the Sierra, you can go up to 5,000 feet, and you know it's going to be hot in the summer and cold in the winter. It's going to be a little moister in the summer than it is down lower. It's going to be a lot colder in the winter. So there's seasons. But in the tropics where you don't have seasons, at each elevation it stays kind of the same temperature year-round too. So one theory is that in a place like the Sierra where you have this flexibility of temperature through the year, animals are adapted. They can handle a little cold. They can handle a little hot. They have to adjust to the seasons. They're pretty flexible. Maybe they move to different habitats based on the seasons and so on. But in the tropics, they get really, really adapted to just this one narrow temperature band. So a particular species might only live in the red Jell-O. They can't move into the green or yellow Jell-O. So they're very adapted to a steady state temperature that's at a certain gradient up a mountain. So that was one reason, and one of the things that the book chapter spends a lot of time talking about is why is there so much diversity in the tropics? And one of the readings we're going to have in this unit is by a guy named Tucker. And he's great. He's one of those writers that I just love. You're going to hate him. But I just love him, and I've only asked you to read small sections of his book chapter. But it's environmental history at its best for me because the ecology is good and the history is good. And one of the things that he talks about is when the American foresters, and we know what they're thinking, right? We know what American foresters were thinking. I think they went to the Philippines. I think the example was about the Philippines. When they first came there, they looked at this forest and they couldn't believe the diversity. And one of the interesting things is, whereas you go up to the Sierra, you see a natural forest. You have a sugar pine here, ponderosa, 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 sugar, sugar, sugar. You know, you see a lot of the same kinds of trees. But in these native, indigenous, tropical forests, you don't. You have one wild fig or whatever here, and then maybe the next one's a mile away. And they have a special insect, just one species of insect, maybe two, that they rely on for pollination. And that insect or that bird has to somehow find the other one and bring their pollen together. Because not very many things are wind-pollinated in the tropics either. Most things are pollinated through fairly complicated mechanisms. A lot of things are complicated. With all this diversity and all this complicated stuff going on, just to get pollinated. So they also mentioned that there's a lot of really powerfully developed what they call mutualisms, which we might call symbiotic relationships, where two things, two animals, two species, a species of animal and a plant, they're somehow have co-evolved to the point where they help each other. They mentioned one species of ant that protects the plants from animals that might want to eat it by stinging anything that gets near and making threatening drumming noises. I'd love to see that. How cool is that? Some plants they make little sugar cups in their leaves so that ants can live, that they can attract the kind of ants they want to live on them. You know, it's really interesting. Other times there's ants and fungus are having a symbiotic relationship, all kinds of things. The pollinators, in a sense, have a symbiotic relationship. If you look at hummingbirds and hibiscus plants, different species of hummingbirds tend to visit different species of hibiscus plants in the tropics. The hibiscus will be specially shaped and adapted for a particular species of hummingbird. And you know, they have the pollen-carrying organ that sticks out. That's the yellow thing that looks so interesting in a hibiscus. And it will be long or short or curved one way or another so that it'll hit the bird in a particular spot. And then only another hibiscus of the same species will hit it in the same spot and pick up the pollen. So really interesting relationships and complicated relationships in the forest. And the book tries to be practical, which I like, and talks about the problems you have when you try to harvest wood. How can you harvest wood from a tropical forest without upsetting all this stuff? How can you do that? So a little bit of the chapter is about that. And Tucker talks about how the original harvest of forests by Chinese merchants and others in the Philippines was they would go around in the forest and they would see a beautiful tree that was of the right kind, probably teak or mahogany. Maybe that's the same thing, I don't know. And they would just go in, cut that tree and take it out. And he said that really wasn't that harmful. That kind of fits the ecological dynamics of the forest. But when we came in with our ideas of scientific forestry, which we've already shown wasn't very well adapted to California, it's kind of a big screw-up in the Philippines. So Tucker does a good job of talking about that. But let's talk about tropical forest ecology so that we can understand something about the ecology of these forests as best as I can explain it. And I really encourage you to read chapter. Okay. So I'm going to start with a little movie. Presuming I can get it to work, but we've been having really good luck in this class, so let's assume that we can. Let's make sure that I have sound on here. Okay. That seems to be working. Oh, I can do this. And hopefully we're at the beginning because it starts off really great. Okay, so let's see. Maybe I can turn off one more set of lights. No, that's not a good one. How about this one? Okay.
Incredibly, 80% of all insects live in jungles. Few are more successful than the ants. There can be 8 million individuals in a single hectare. But jungle ants don't have it all their own way. These bullet ants are showing some worrying symptoms. Spores from a parasitic fungus called cordyceps have infiltrated their bodies and their minds. Its infected brain directs this ant upwards. Then, utterly disorientated, it grips a stem with its mandibles. Those afflicted that are discovered by the workers are quickly taken away and dumped far away from the colony. It seems extreme, but this is the reason why. Like something out of science fiction, the fruiting body of the cordyceps erupts from the ant's head. It can take 3 weeks to grow, and when finished, the deadly spores will burst from its tip. Then, any ant in the vicinity will be in serious risk of death. The fungus is so virulent, it can wipe out whole colonies of ants. And it's not just ants that fall victim to this killer. There are, literally, thousands of different types of cordyceps fungi, and remarkably, each specializes on just one species. Attacks do have a positive effect on the jungle's diversity, since parasites like these stop any one group of animal getting the upper hand. The more numerous a species becomes, the more likely it will be attacked by its nemesis, a cordyceps fungus.
Okay. Do you want to say it again? No, probably enough. Okay, so they are espousing one theory of why there's so much diversity in the tropical forest. What theory was he saying? What was he saying is the reason for diversity? I think it's Richard Attenborough. Anybody got a pick up on that? He was just saying it at the end. Yes? Okay, that is one really good theory, and the book talks about it. And that is, I think that you could make a case for that. He's saying every species has its own fungus, right? Every species that the cordyceps attacks has its own particular kind of cordyceps fungi. And that would fit in with the idea that you have a lot of different kinds of hummingbirds and plants and trees, that in the tropics there's so many different niches. Doesn't really answer the question of why are there so many different niches. If you're talking about niches, which is kind of an envelope that defines a habitat, like a certain climate, temperature, this or that, we have an awful lot of them in California because we have really heterogeneous soils and really lots of elevations and lots of this and that. So we might have a lot of niches too. Yeah? Yeah, he was proposing, and I don't know if this is true, the chapter says, really, we haven't got a great idea about it. We've got a lot of arguments about it, which is great. No problem with that. But, he's saying that one of the reasons, and the book talks about this too, that in a warm, wet climate, it's so easy for plants and diseases and fungi to grow in, If you're a monoculture, if there's a lot of the same kind of a species, it's going to evolve an equally high number of predators or diseases or fungi that prey on it. So his idea about what maintains diversity is that as soon as a species becomes too common, it gets taken back by a predator that has evolved to take it back. Okay, so that's one theory about diversity in the tropics. There's a lot of them. Other people would say, to get back to the niche idea, that because the climate is so steady state and blah, 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 you can have a lot of niche differentiation. There's enough time for animals to specialize and become these highly specialized organisms because they're not worried about environmental fluctuation or environmental change. So competitive interactions and so on leads to a lot of new niches. So that's another theory that they talk about in the book, and they talk about that as sort of the time theory. You've had a lot of time without much disturbance. Now, of course, one thing we're going to become aware of is that tropical forests do experience a fair amount of disturbance. Hurricanes and typhoons knock down the trees, fires. There are oftentimes people who live in the tropics set fires. Fires are not uncommon in the tropics. They used to talk about the virgin rainforest, and it's questionable exactly what that means these days with what we're finding out about the history of rainforests, thousands of years of human burning and cultivation in some of them. So those are some of the theories that people use to talk about why there is so much diversity. And I'll go back to it when I'm going over the book, and you'll find out it's in the notes. I've listed several different explanations. Let's look at these slides so we can get them out of the way. The tropics, as I've mentioned already, are along the equator for the most part, these dark green areas. Tropical and subtropical moist broad-leaved forest. Broad-leaved, I mean, one thing about the tropics that the chapter makes a fairly big deal about is that there's a lot of big leaves and oftentimes a very high ratio of leaf material to woody material. What does that mean in terms of nutrient cycling and carbon storage? Yes, there you are. Well, they're actually, some of the temperate cold forests store more carbon above ground per acre than tropical forests. But it does have to do with carbon. But one of the reasons is because that material is cycling through quickly. Leaf material doesn't hang around for a long time. It's really interesting when they talk about the dynamics of the fallen leaves in the tropical forest, but they're consumed really rapidly and oftentimes directly by the roots of the trees. They don't let them get into the soil and get leached of their nutrients because the soils tend to be relatively acid. The leaves are consumed almost immediately and recycled into the trees as nutrients. So cycling happens really fast, comparatively quickly, in the tropical forest. Whereas you can see in an old forest, conifer forest, you don't have very much leaf material, really, compared to the amount of wood. You have this solid wood that just hangs around, which is carbon. So when you look... Wow. That could be embarrassing. Okay, when you look at the amount of above ground versus below ground carbon storage, in the tropical wet, you have a decent amount of carbon being stored in there. But in the cool temperate forests, like the conifer forests, you have a lot more above ground carbon being stored per hectare than you do in the tropical forest because it's busy being cycled and being used. And this emphasizes again that we find this in the equatorial zones. And when we look at the number of species, it's pretty amazing how many there are in tropical forests compared, especially tropical moist forests, compared to other forest types. So we talked about carbon storage in these temperate forests. Well, they may store a lot of carbon, but the tropics store a lot of species. And we talked about a latitudinal gradient, just to reiterate that. Down here near the equator, way more species than up here higher. And there's variation, of course, and that has to do with elevation, with disturbance events, all kinds of things. But the general trend as we see in this butterfly slide, which I've shown before, is that biodiversity tends to be at its peak in these moist tropical forests. Important gradient. Now, one of the things that's happening in the tropics, because there are so many species, there's a lot of opportunities for bio-prospecting, for people to go and try to find botanical chemicals. You know, a lot of the chemicals that we use every day are sort of discovered by accident, like artificial sweeteners. They're trying to make oil or something, and they find something sweet, and then they put it in everything that you eat when you don't want to eat sugar. So things are, a lot of them have been discovered by accident. Penicillin was discovered pretty much by accident. But when you have more species, you have more chances to find chemicals that could be marketable as medicine or could be used as medicine. This is, I believe, a dragon's blood tree. And I forgot to sort of nail that down in my brain. But this is a very recent discovery. This is one of the first, I think it's the first botanical product, the sap of this tree, licensed by the Food and Drug Administration for use in treating some of the bad symptoms of treatment for AIDS. Okay, and the sap is, you can see why it's called the dragon's blood tree when you see the sap. The drug is called crofelemer. It's the first oral botanical drug approved for use in AIDS. It has a lot of other applications that might be useful with other problems that people have, but right now it's licensed for use in the kinds of symptoms that people get when they're treated for AIDS. The sap has been commonly sold for a long time as a nutritional supplement. And one of the ironies of this licensing is that there is a company that might have a patent on this sap. So you won't be able to buy it as a nutritional supplement anymore. It won't be so easy to get. You'll have to pay the drug company and you'll have to go through them to get this sap. So it goes away from the free market or away from being over-the-counter easily available to an actual FDA-approved drug. So there's two sides to this. I mean, the fact that a drug company could license it and have a patent on it and market it is why they send people out to try to find these things. But it also means that a traditional nutritional supplement that might have once been available relatively inexpensively will no longer be available so inexpensively. And another thing that happens sometimes is that the indigenous people who live in these areas often get no benefit and don't get to share in these drugs or in the profits from these products, even though they may have shown someone where they are and said, here's what we use for X or here's what we use for Y. Oftentimes they have no rights or no property rights in the product when it's sold. Now to get back to the ants, the fungus that was affecting these ants, when I first found this video, I thought, wow, this is fascinating. I have to show it to the class. It really shows, you know, species specificity and diversity, and the guy's got a cool accent, and the ant thing's growing out of their head. That's great. I mean, he says 80% of the ants in the world are found in the tropics. I think they're in my kitchen, frankly. And so I need this fungi, actually, although I'm not sure I want, oh well. Anyway, what if there's a human version? So last fall, I went to China, and I was at the airport leaving a province, the province next to Tibet, Qinghai. And they were selling these wonderful objects in the airport. Anybody here from China or familiar with this product? Yes, your relatives really think it's great. You're familiar with it as a gift or a medicine or something? Yeah. So that price is really high. That's 29,000 yen. Which is about, divide 8 into it, or 9 into it, or 7 into it now. So it's about, what, $4,000, I think? About $4,000 for this packet of caterpillars that have been infected with cordyceps fungus. Okay, so the cordyceps, these caterpillars, I believe, are a little bit under the ground. And this is probably one of the, well, I'm sure it is the most valuable thing that Tibetans can take out of the land. So this has become kind of a problem in China. They used to be found in the mountains of Tibet and Qinghai above 3,500 feet. Now they've been so overhunted that they're only found above 4,500 feet, so they're becoming rarer. Tibetan families will take their kids out of school during caterpillar hunting season and go up there and hunt these caterpillars, which, of course, is bad for the kids' education. And it's bad for the land as well because they're digging in the rangeland soil. But it's worth so much. How could you resist going out and trying to get this stuff? And, of course, Tibetan people have been up there a long time living, and now a lot of people that are not Tibetan want to get this fungus too. So it's kind of a mess. Here's another way it looks. They dry it and put it in pellets, or in, I think that thing on the right is a liquid form. I refrained from purchasing this. There's evidently now fake cordyceps-infected caterpillars, which look quite close to the real thing. But this market, because it's bought and valued so much by other people all over the world, it's having a very local impact on the soils and the rangelands. And that happens with all of these, with a lot of these products in the tropics as well. Yes? Oh, I forgot to mention that. It's a medicine. It's supposed to cure stuff. It's a medicinal product. So people believe that it's a good medicine. I don't remember exactly what specifically it cures. Do you guys know what it's good for? Well, it's good for stuff. And there's some specific things. I'm sure that if you could read the package, it would tell you what it's good for. So it's a medicinal, highly valued. Just like that dragon's blood stuff was. What's going to protect those trees in the tropics from being over-harvested for that sap? Probably we'll learn how to synthesize it. But one of the points of this class and why we call it the global forest is to realize that what you purchase and how you purchase it can have a big impact on the local environment all over the world, of environments all over the world. So this is a Tibetan herding family. And for them, this is, you know, normally they're just living out there with their animals, and the going out and hunting these caterpillars is a tremendous opportunity to make a lot of money for them. So of course they do. You notice she's got some mushrooms that she's drying down here in her little stove. The people who gather mushrooms, they gather all kinds of things from these environments for their own use. That's for their own use. Okay, so, but one other thing I saw now, this is another part of China in the north of Mongolia, Inner Mongolia, and I said to the person I was with, what are all those people, and this is not a good picture because it's sunset, I just have a point and shoot camera, right, but it's a whole bunch of people on motorcycles, and what they're doing is they're out collecting something called xiezi, which is a scorpion sort of thing that's also valued as a medicine. Have you heard of it too? Gosh, you guys know a lot. So it's a medicine, and they want to go out in a group. They wait till sunset because it's illegal just to go out on these lands and collect these things. They wait until sunset when it's dark, and they trap and they can't hopefully be caught. But they also travel in groups or gangs because they want to be able to beat up anybody who tries to stop them. So even including the police if necessary, you know, just. So this is another case where people want these medicinals, but it has an effect on the local environment. This is not a tropical forest, by the way, but I haven't been to the tropics really much. So these are my examples that I've seen of how a market for medicinals can affect the environment. So they go out and hunt through scorpions, and it causes some damage to the rangeland when they do that. During the daytime, we were out visiting some people, and we ran across these guys hanging around, and these are Mongolian herding people, and they have some camels and some goats and some sheep out there. This land belongs to a little cooperative that they have, and they are out there to protect the land from people who are coming out there to either hunt the scorpions, or there's another kind of grass that everybody wants, fatai. And this guy, you see, has a big stick, and they had just beat some guy off of the land who was out there collecting things. And this is him and his friend running away. And they were very proud that they'd managed to vanquish this enemy. But in fact, people don't have very much money, and here's an opportunity to make some that's really hard to resist. Really hard to resist. So how do we deal with situations like that? And there's nonprofit organizations and governmental organizations all over the world trying to grapple with exactly this sort of problem. People who are not rich, but who see an opportunity to get more money, more stuff for their family, send their kids to college, pay the doctor. And yet when they do that, it offends us because it damages the environment. And probably in the long term will damage them. And how do we cope with that all around the world? The tropics is a good example of that as well. So I think that's all of those. Okay. All right. So I'm going to talk from my notes, which you have. All right. And I'm going to be able to see them now, about the tropics and about the chapter that you're supposed to read. The tropical forest has been called the lungs of the earth. We'll see a little video about that next time. I changed the notes a little bit because I wanted to show a different video today. I wanted to show the ants. I thought it fit in better with the chapter that's about diversity rather than Harrison Ford. We saw enough of him on Thursday. But they're often called the lungs of the earth. Tropical forests do store some carbon. We talked about that. But the forests are responsible for not really producing a lot of oxygen. In fact, they're considered oxygen neutral. But they do turn over almost a third of the earth's oxygen and cycle it through the forest system. And as I mentioned, cycling happens pretty fast. They take in oxygen to create, they take in oxygen as part of their transpiration and respiration processes, and they release oxygen. But they keep carbon, so they do store some carbon. But they don't necessarily produce a lot of oxygen. They've been called the world's largest pharmacy because over one quarter of natural medicines have been discovered in the tropics. And that makes sense because they have so much diversity, so much species diversity. So when we think of the tropical forests, it's not so much about producing oxygen or storing carbon, except that they're huge, and they do store some carbon. The rangeons are huge. They store very little carbon per hectare, grasslands, but there's so many of them that in the end they store a lot of the world's carbon. It's not that they're fantastic necessarily at producing oxygen or storing carbon, but they're fantastic at biodiversity, absolutely fantastic. We have covered this. They help regulate global climate patterns and help mitigate the negative effects of climate change by sinking carbon, by attracting it, by keeping it in their system, just like all forests. All right. Since the Industrial Revolution, half of the 7.1 million square miles of virgin, and remember I have some skepticism about virgin, tropical forest has been destroyed. A further 1.9 million square miles has been selectively logged with large clearings created. So there's been a lot said about tropical forest deforestation. A lot of that forest has grown back. But it seems that there's still net deforestation in tropical forests. I think most people would agree. But a Smithsonian National Museum conference in 2009 reported that secondary forests, that's forests that grow back after they've been cut, were emerging, where small farms have been abandoned. In much of the world, people are moving to the cities. And so as they abandon those farms, they revert back to forests. So in some places, there's actually a lot of forests coming in as people started to move to the cities and abandon their small farms. And that is a kind of a positive trend. But on the other hand, more and more big corporations are going into tropical, subtropical areas, mowing down everything in their path and converting them to other things. I went to Argentina last year, and there was just these huge companies would come in, clear tons and tons of acres of mesquite forests, and plant it to soybeans because there's a huge soybean market, both for people and for feeding animals. So they would convert all these huge areas. So the deforestation, once upon a time, 20 years ago, everybody was talking about how these poor campesinos or poor people go out into the forest and clear for farms, and that causes rainforest destruction. There's a very famous article by Susanna Hecht called The Logic of livestock production in the forest. We've all heard about, you know, destroy the rainforest to make hamburgers. But she talked about how it was very much similar to what I've just been talking about, these medicinals. You had poor farmers They needed to make a living. They didn't have any land. They were given a chance. The government would say, here, you can have this rainforest or this tropical forest area. You clear it and develop it, and it's yours. And they would do that, and they needed to have a few livestock around for meat and milk and everything else. And so that conversion 20 or 30 years ago was a lot about that, about relatively poor people having the opportunity to have a farm. Today, it's not so much. It's about a big corporation, agricultural corporation, deciding that they're going to get a bunch of investors together and buy 1,000 acres of this forest scrub, tropical forest area, and they're going to grow soybeans there and make a bundle. So the picture of what's causing deforestation in the tropics has changed, and we can expect a loss of 15 to 50% of species in the tropics as a result. The loss of forests worldwide contributes about a fifth of the world's emissions of carbon dioxide. That's pretty interesting, a fifth of the world's emissions of carbon dioxide. So if we could stop converting forests to agricultural systems, farms, urban development, if we could stop that, we could handle 20% of our carbon emissions problems could be solved that way. Farms emit a lot of carbon. The soil's constantly being disturbed, plants are being picked, you know, blah, blah, blah. They emit a lot of carbon. So why should we care about diversity in the tropics? Some people just consider it an intrinsic moral value that we don't wipe out species if we can help it. I think it's a good policy not to wipe out other species. So for some of it's a moral or ethical thing. But we've just seen some examples that valuable medicines can be found in species that we don't even appreciate or know about yet. Some of them are very effective, some of them less so. The tropics is a system where diversity is used to combat pests and diseases, and so there's a lot of different forms of resistance to pests and diseases, and we could learn something from that, from tropical forests. Also, when you have diversity, the book talks about something called over-yielding. It must have been invented by an engineer. What a stupid term. But it means that if you planted an acre of all one kind of tree, you would get a certain amount of productivity, of net primary productivity, of carbon cycled, of forest growth, of things that you could harvest. But if you plant it with a mix of species, it's more productive. Why would it be more productive? If you have tall trees and short trees, or thin trees and fat trees, what? Trees with big leaves, trees with small leaves. As opposed to all one kind of tree, which looks nice and neat and orderly and is how we like to see things. Yeah? Yeah, you can grow more stuff because you might have some big trees at the top, and then you have some little trees that can fit in underneath. So overall, you get more things growing when you have different sizes and shapes of them in a forest, right? And many of our houseplants are tropical plants that grow in the shade of these tropical forests. And, you know, they have these huge leaves. That's why we like to have them as houseplants, so that they can collect light in the understory of the forest. We like that. So there's plants that are adapted to living in the shade, and they do very well, and they add productivity, whereas if you had just one tree species, you wouldn't have that growing down below, and you just have less productivity. You know, the same is true of livestock. You know, traditional herding people usually have a mix of livestock because different species don't eat the same things. Cows like grass, goats like bushes, deer like bushes. When you have them together, they don't compete directly. They are eating different things in the environment. So you can produce more meat and more milk if you have a mix of animals than if you have only one kind. And in addition, in a traditional herder's flock, you have more disease resistance when you have a mixed herd. Because if some disease comes in that kills sheep, you've still got your camels to live off of, right? So mixed herds, mixed forests, they make a lot of sense in those two dimensions. More productive per acre and more disease resistant. But we've decided generally in our society today, some people, that it's better to produce homogeneous blocks of things where you only have to use one kind of equipment, you only can sell all your tomatoes the same size, whatever. Just, we do monocultures in our society. Forests, not so much. We're required in many areas to plant a number of different species now because we understand that in a forest system, we need that pest resistance and we need that diversity. Okay, well, things that influence diversity, we've gone over a lot of these. Latitude, right? Latitudinal gradients I've talked about. Elevation. So you might have two forests in the same area, but one's higher than the other. One's going to be cooler than the other. Elevation. There's this thing called the adiabatic lapse rate. I don't know if you've seen pictures of like Bali High, the tropics. Sometimes they have these mountains that come out of, old volcanoes that come out of these islands. In small islands, you get even more developed elevational gradients because when the air, there's just a little island and all this ocean air and it rises up relatively quickly and cools relatively quickly. So you have dramatic and lower down elevational gradients than you do on large land masses because the air cools faster as it rises on islands. Because you have a smaller, warm land mass for the air at the bottom to be warmed. Interesting. soils. Very interesting. Sometimes richer soils have less diversity. You know that's true in the California grassland? Our richest soils have less native species today of grasses. And that's oftentimes because when soils are not so rich, when there's diversity in soil fertility, you just have more different kinds of species adapted to dealing with infertile, less fertile soils. And you have more niches and you have more different things going on. In California, the non-native grasses that we have that kind of swamp our native grasses grow really, really well. They love rich bottom land, they do fantastically. But when you get to places where there's something chemically wrong with the soils or where they're very infertile, you see a lot of native species because they're adapted to that, because species have adapted to those infertile patches. So you often, it just because something's more rich, has more nitrogen in the soil, that can reduce diversity because more species, because species have a more of an opportunity to compete with each other and for one to become dominant. So you can have a soil enrichment that reduces diversity, but you can also have in the tropics a richer environment with more diversity. So both things can happen. Stress. They talk about defining stress on plants and how some ecologists say there's no such thing as stress because plants are adapted to the conditions where they're found, and so that's just an environmental effect when you talk about stress. But in the book, they decide that stress means that the environmental conditions are in the area are not optimal, perfectly optimal for plants. So it may be too dry, too salty, nutrients too poor, and that it may lower diversity, that kind of stress. A lot of other factors have been used to explain patterns in diversity. So I've talked about latitude, elevation. Characteristics of the soil can be used, can show patterns in diversity. Stress, different kinds of stresses that might be so salty here or not salty there that can have different patterns of diversity on each. Another one is just plain the size of the area. How many species have reached that area? How many can grow in the size of that particular environment? One theory about, it was mentioned here about multiple niches and why there might be so many in the tropics, is because it's a huge, in many places, a huge contiguous area of the same climate and many of the same characteristics. So you have a huge area and that leads to more niches. All right, so here are some theories that people have used to explain diversity, and some of them we've gone over already. Time. When you have more time, more diversity can evolve. However, a counter argument to that would be that without barriers, these species are just going to keep mixing with each other and they're not going to differentiate. One of the ways that species differentiate in evolutionary time is that they become isolated from each other. But in a huge, contiguous, relatively stable tropical environment, you don't have species becoming isolated from each other and then having genetic drift and becoming different species, right? So how does that work? But nonetheless, time is one thing that's been put out there. Spatial heterogeneity, there's more niches, more in the tropics, perhaps due to the fact that species don't have to adapt to seasons, so they're more restricted to narrow niches. Are you ready to say hi to someone this morning? Ready? Hi. Okay. So I don't know why I expect them to be trained. They're poor, clueless people, but it's fun anyway. Climatic stability. So when I talked about that earlier, when species don't, when there's no, like the jello, when things are really stable, they don't have to be very flexible, so they differentiate within these very narrow zones. Competition, when you've got the optimal environment, it's warm, it's wet, plants can grow, so they compete with each other, and animals compete with each other a lot, and that causes them to differentiate. Predation, that's the one that was talked about in the cordyceps talk. When you have a lot of a particular kind of animal, you get a lot of its predators, and that keeps them in check. So in this optimal environment where you can have a lot of diseases and pests, as well as, I hate to call them pests, but, you know, things that eat other things, these keep species from growing into anybody becoming dominant. So that's a theory, and that's the one that the guy in the movie was talking about. Productivity, just because there's higher productivity, we have more species. Maybe because they're just so huge. Well, there are other large zones, like the tundra, which are not particularly diverse. The intermediate disturbance hypothesis, you have maximum diversity at intermediate disturbance levels. That's an interesting one, and we will talk about it more in the class, but it means that if you have an environment where everything's the same all the time, then you don't have very much diversity because things compete out, and you just have the species that are dominant in that particular area. If you have a species where you have disturbance all the time, then not very many species can really survive in that environment. But some can, but there are species that can survive with a lot of disturbance, so you don't have very many species. But in the middle, where you have some disturbance, but not a lot, you get a lot of diversity. And in the tropics, one way that could happen is through something called gap dynamics. And gap dynamics, you could think of it as the opposite of clear cutting, as a way of regenerating or causing a forest to regrow. Or remember when we talked about Yellowstone, the lodgepole pine, and how it seems like that forest commonly regenerates itself by burning down every 200 years and then growing from scratch. So huge areas, I'm looking at the time, huge areas where the forest has been cleared, that forest regenerates really well under those conditions. In the tropics, that's not the case. The natural pattern of regeneration in the tropics is a few, aside from sometimes a hurricane or something, is a tree falls down. It gets old, it falls down. So you get what's called a small gap. And then things grow back in that gap. And what does that mean? That means that that gap is relatively sheltered from the environment. It remains partly shaded, so it doesn't dry out. There's still a lot of litter, a lot of leaves and dead material on the ground, which is really important for nutrient cycling, which the chapter explains really well. So in those gaps is how the forest regenerates itself. And that's a moderate form of disturbance, right? So that maybe that helps stimulate diversity, that form of regeneration. But remember that gap dynamics, that's important. That form of regrowth and regeneration and replacement of the forest, gap dynamics is important as we move along. All right. In the end, the book concludes by saying what we really should be asking is, why is there so little diversity every place else? We're looking at it the wrong way. All right. They talk about reproduction in tropical trees. Sometimes trees don't regenerate every year. Sometimes it's a number of years before they regenerate. We talked about pollinators being very specific and so on. Trees are widely scattered. The pollinators need to find the trees that are related. Mutualisms, covered that. When you get up to the higher elevations in the tropics where it's cooler, interestingly, there's more wind pollination and less of these really complicated mutualisms. They seem to happen down in the lower latitudes. And then a common traditional land use is slash and burn agriculture. Cutting down small patches of forest, burning them, and then planting them and growing in those small gaps for a few years, then leaving the gaps regrow and you move somewhere else. This is slash and burn. Doesn't sound very positive, slash and burn agriculture. Scientists now call it swidden. Swidden's an important word in this class. Tucker talks about it. One of the first things, guess what, that foresters tried to do when they started managing Philippine forests was to make swidden illegal and eliminate it. Get rid of that slash and burn agriculture. How can it be okay to set fire to an area, farm it, and then leave, abandon it? How can that be okay? That's called swidden. So one of their first goals was to make that stop. All right, so let's finish, because I think I've basically covered all these other things to some extent. Yes, one thing you need to know, though, they talk about light distribution. Light in tropical forests. Light and its availability and who gets it when is one of the main things that affects the way tropical forests grow. Okay? Because plants in that warm, wet environment, they grow tall, they compete for light. So a lot of plants have to adapt to less light. They have these big leaves. And some of them need partly shaded areas to grow best as seeds. So that's why gap dynamics works for them. They like to stay in a sheltered area. Mahogany, by contrast, need more light. Mahoganies need more light than some of the other trees. So you might only get a mahogany when you have a reasonably big gap in the forest. Okay? And mahogany for a long time maybe still is the most valuable tree in a lot of these forests. Very valuable tree, mahogany. All right, so when you're talking, let's talk about swidden and patterns of disturbance and slash and burn and gap dynamics just for a few minutes here at the end of this lecture. Swidden sets off a pattern of succession, of forest regrowth, right? Secondary succession. Gaps do when trees fall down or when a farmer goes in and clears an area. He's setting off then a process of secondary succession, of regrowth of the forest, okay? What determines what's going to grow there and how it looks? Well, one thing is chance. What kind of seeds get there? And they talk in the book about how these animals, a lot of animals, birds, all these creatures distribute seeds in the forest. Birds eat fruit and then they crap. And the seeds in the crap are someplace else, and where they crap is where these particular trees have a chance to grow. A little pellet of fertilizer plus the seeds, right? Great. So a lot of animals have roles spreading around seeds. So one thing is, what seeds are there to grow? And when do they arrive? Okay, that's going to affect what's going to regrow in a gap. Another thing, because we've talked about how important light is how big the gap is. If it's a small gap and it's very shady, species that do well in the shade and that can regrow from a seed in the shade are going to come in better than species that need a lot of sunlight. Last unit, we talked about how for some Sierran trees, for example, a clear cut is the ideal way to regenerate them because they want no litter fall. They don't want any dead material on the ground. I think ponderosa pine is one of those. And they want a lot of sunlight. So they regenerate best when you clear a forest or have clear cutting. So that's one of the reasons people did it. But in the tropics, most species do better in a gap. The native species tend to do better in the gap. But in a larger gap, the ones that like sunlight more and need more sunlight are going to do better than in a smaller gap. So the size of the gap is important. What are the conditions around for pollinators? Are there lots of pollinators? or there are not very many? What are the species that happen to be around that gap? Those affect what's going to regrow there, what kind of plants got pollinated. And then how long is it going to remain a gap? After a tree falls, things start regrowing right away. But if somebody's using it for agriculture, they're going to maintain it as a gap for a while. Why would they burn it? What would be a logical reason to burn? You've cut down the trees, they're laying there. Why would you burn them if you're going to farm there? Yeah. Yeah, you might be clearing an area to plant. They do leave, though, a thick layer of ash and plant into it. So they're not going to plow it like we do. People usually plant with sticks. And they leave this thick layer of ash. And that's a good hypothesis. It's really way easier to burn than to hack away at stuff if you don't have a wood chipper or something. Yeah. Yeah, that most of the nutrients in the tropical forest are in the plants. Remember, the leaves fall, they're immediately sucked up by the roots and put back into the trees. Once it gets into the soil, it tends to get leached. Tropical soils are not great. They're heavily leached by water. They tend to be acidic. So the plants want to keep the nutrients in the system. So they send out these fine roots. They talk about the fine root mats in the chapter that just sucks up the leaves' nutrients as fast as they can. So to release some of those nutrients to grow in, they will burn the plants that they've cleared so that those nutrients are then available for a while. Then why don't they just stay there and have this happy little farm for 20 years, forever, for their lives, and then pass it on to their children, and they can pass it on to their children? Yeah. Yeah, those nutrients eventually will be lost. They will be leached away. So for a few years, they can grow things very well, and then after a while, they have to move on. So that's how Swidden works. Right? So in a traditional forest where Swidden is a practice, you'll have areas that have been used for farming 100 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, last year, patches all throughout the forest that are in various stages of successional regrowth. That also, it seems to me, contributes to diversity in the tropical forest. Right. So think about that. Think about Swidden. I think we have covered the chapter. Be sure to read it, though. And I'll see you on Thursday. I have a very exciting video for Thursday. Very exciting. Short.